This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehayes Wahib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
We just see that the situation is just deteriorating over and over. It's kind of full war inside the city. So unfortunately, there is no protection of civilians, no protection of health structures whatsoever.
That was Claire Nicolet of Doctors Without Borders on the deteriorating conditions in the North Darfur State Hospital capital, El Fasher, as Sudanese paramilitary forces attack hospitals and camps. Details coming up. Also, the Africa Center for the Study of the United States has been launched in Nairobi, and a clash between two clans in central Somalia has killed at least 55 people and injured 155. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. In Sudan's North Darfur state, displaced people and doctors say the paramilitary rapid support forces are attacking hospitals and camps in the state capital of El Fasher. Meanwhile, aid groups say the world is paying little attention as a city that was supposed to be a haven for those forced out of their homes by Sudan's war is being torn apart. Henry Wilkins has the story.
El Fasher, the capital city of North Darfur State, was supposed to be safe. About 800,000 people displaced by fighting and alleged ethnic cleansing in the surrounding Darfur countryside have fled here hoping to find refuge. But since mid-April, El Fasher too has become a war zone. Refugee camps have been caught in the crossfire and even shelled as the Sudanese military battles the paramilitary rapid support forces for control of the city. More than 1,200 have been killed, says Doctors Without Borders. From inside El Fasher, Adam Rojal, a spokesperson for a local non-profit helping Darfur's displaced, told VOA that people here don't care about the warring sides. They just want the fighting to stop. He says the military and the RSF are not patriots and are fighting only in their own interests, adding that the only loser is Sudanese society, especially people in Darfur. He says people have lost everything, even basic needs to live, like food, water, shelter, and medicine. He says words can't describe how serious the situation is. Claire Nicolette works with the non-profit Doctors Without Borders, which operates medical facilities in El Fasher. She said one of its maternity wards was shelled, as well as the main surgical hospital.
The roof fall down on babies that were inside the hospital, and we had to close down after the death of these two children. Surgical hospital, I can say, which is receiving all the wounded at the moment, has been touched four times now in 10 days.
Nicolette said calls from the UN, US Secretary of State Antony Blinken, and other members of the international community to end the fighting in El Fasher have gone unheeded. She says the situation is only getting worse and that the violence is indiscriminate.
We hear about drones now, we hear about snipers. We just see that the situation is just deteriorating over and over. It's kind of full war inside the city. So unfortunately, there is no protection of civilians, no protection of health structures whatsoever. That's the reality.
Rojal says the fighting has prevented people from leaving the city and aid groups from delivering food to the starving within its borders. He says families are living in dire conditions, himself included, because they're not getting aid from the UN's World Food Programme because of the poor security and conditions of the blockade. Every day, he has been desperately sending pictures of malnourished children in El Fasher to the international press to try to get the world's attention. Non-profits have complained about the unusually low donations for the Sudan crisis, in part because of the Ukraine and Gaza wars, while human rights groups have criticised the UN and African Union for not doing enough. Meanwhile, El Fasher continues to be ripped apart. Henry Wilkins, VOA News.
We have an urgent news break. Malawi's president and cabinet today has said a Malawi military plane carrying Vice President Saulus Klaus Chilima did not arrive as scheduled earlier today at the Mzuzu International Airport. In a statement issued to the nation, the president's office says efforts to contact the aircraft has failed. President Lazarus Chikawera has cancelled plans to leave for the Bahamas and ordered all regional and national organizations to immediately search for the plane. VOAAfrica.com will have updates on the story as it develops. A bipartisan group of four U.S. lawmakers oppose a White House deal to ease sanctions on an Israeli billionaire so he can sell off his mining assets in the Democratic Republic of Congo. As Carol Van Dam explains, the lawmakers and some rights groups oppose the deal because the mining executive is accused of corrupt business dealings in the DRC.
Under a framework agreement offered by the White House, mining executive Dan Gertler would be allowed to sell his financial stake in three copper and cobalt mines in the Democratic Republic of Congo as part of a move to get him out of the country's mining business. According to the New York Times newspaper and the Bloomberg News Agency, top Biden officials say the deal will help the DRC, which is the world's largest producer of cobalt, because it will encourage more Western-leaning companies to invest in that African country. The news reports say investors have been reluctant to get involved in the DRC, as Gertler was accused of relying on his close ties with former President Joseph Kabila to get permits, paying below market prices. Those deals created concerns that the entire mining industry was tainted. Gertler has always maintained that his DRC operations were legal. Four members of Congress sent a letter to U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken and Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen recently outlining their concern. "We fear that if sanctions are removed, Mr. Gertler will profit massively off his ill-gotten assets to the detriment of the Congolese people," said the lawmakers. The letter was signed by Republican Representative Joe Wilson, Democratic Senator Ben Cardin, Democratic Representative Steve Cohen, and Republican Senator Roger Wicker. Annika Woudenberg, executive director of RAID, a nonprofit group that tracks mining operations in Africa, including the DRC, agrees with the lawmakers.
"What this deal would allow is for an easing of sanctions against him without any kind of accountability. Dan Gertler would stand to benefit in the multi-millions, money from royalties, which should go back to the Congolese people. Even the U.S. government says these were ill-gotten gains, and why he would be allowed to walk away with significant amounts of funding remains, I have to say, a total mystery."
Woudenberg says under the White House proposal, Gertler would be allowed to keep the money he gets from selling his assets, which she says should go back to the Congolese people.
"What this proposed framework agreement that the U.S. government seems to be putting out there would allow him to reap the benefits from those royalties for many years to come, but being paid in one lump payment. And that just doesn't seem right. It's like stealing the crown jewels and giving nothing back and walking away with them when everyone agrees you've stolen them in the first place."
Kim Donovan, director of the Atlantic Council's Economic Statecraft Initiative, says at first she was shocked to hear about the deal. But she points out that under President Barack Obama, the Treasury Secretary then said sanctions were not working as intended.
Secretary Jack Lew of the Treasury Department at the time had laid out the fact that we were overusing sanctions as a national security tool. And it's something that, you know, the Trump administration, especially as it related to Iran with maximum economic pressure, the sanctions were just more and more and more.
Donovan says under the deal, U.S. sanctions against Gertler remain in place, but he'd get to sell his assets, which she sees as a good thing for the DRC and in keeping with the Biden administration's push for more clean energy solutions to fossil fuels. Today, Chinese-based companies own or are majority stakeholders in most cobalt-producing sites in the DRC. Gertler's lawyers are said to be still considering the White House offer. Carol Van Dam for VOA News, Washington.
The U.S. and Kenya are exploring new opportunities to strengthen their ties following President William Ruto's state visit to Washington last month. In Kenya, the University of Nairobi has just launched the Africa Center for the Study of the United States. VOA's Ruben Chama spoke with Winnie Ragat, the center's program director and a lecturer at the Department of Diplomacy and International Studies. She started by explaining what the Africa Center for the Study of the U.S. is all about.
The center is a space for dialogue. It's a space for engagement on U.S.-Africa relations in Kenya, but we also serve the region. And the idea behind the center is to have a space for thought leaders, for scholars, for experts to be able to critically evaluate what does the relationship with the United States mean for the people of Africa. We have a community of scholars and policymakers who are interested in having valuable conversations around U.S.-Africa relations. This is an African-driven center, mainly being run by critical thinkers, and we want conversations to be influenced by Africans and those who are most affected by these diplomatic relations between the U.S. and different African countries.
Recently, the president made a high-level state visit. What is your perspective on this new improved relationship between Kenya in particular and the U.S.?
Of course, the U.S. and Kenya have been in close ties for more than 60 years since Kenya gained independence. We know that there's a lot of enthusiasm about this, but it's enthusiasm with some form of caution, because we know that all these development partners have their interests. And so for scholars, yes, we are excited. We want to see good things for the continent. But there's a lot of conversation of whether this renewed partnership will be in the benefit of the country.
What do you think a country like Kenya should be asking from the United States? What sort of technologies, what kind of issues that need to be given priority?
Of interest to us is definitely development, economic growth, getting more jobs, making sure our streets are more secure, and having investment partners that are able to help us grow. We want to make sure we have development financing to support our growth and also supporting our security interests in the region, because as you know, Kenya is an anchor state in the region. And it's a region that is, in many ways, there are hotspots of conflict in the north, in Sudan, we have the DRC. So we also want a partner that will work with us in our security challenges.
And finally, China has also been courting many African countries, including Kenya. What does this new improved ties with the U.S. mean for the relationship between Kenya and China?
What I strongly believe is that Kenya is a country that needs all the development partners it can get. And we do not have the luxury to look east or west. We have the luxury only of looking forward. Yes, without a doubt, this renewed strength and partnership with the United States will cause jitters in Beijing. We won't deny that. But it is my hope that the Kenyan government is seeing how to walk a tightrope, because China is a very important development partner here in Kenya. Quite a number of our roads, our rail, have been built by Chinese. We have Chinese businessmen. China has brought in something that is unique about China compared to the United States, is that foreign direct investment from China is also quite heavy. And so I do not think it's the policy of government to sideline China. It is, however, my hope that we see a way as a country to maintain both partners in a mutually beneficial way. We want to make sure we are moving forward for our country and the continent.
That was Winnie Ragat, a program director at the University of Nairobi's New Africa Center for the Study of the United States and a lecturer at the Department of Diplomacy and International Studies, speaking with Ruben Chama from Nairobi. You're listening to African News Tonight on The Voice of America, and for more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you'll find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. A clash over the weekend between two clans in central Somalia has killed at least 55 people and injured 155. Somalia's federal government is struggling to contain violence unleashed by the Al-Qaeda-linked Al-Shabaab group and also faces clan-based fighting over control of land and water in the Horn of Africa nation. The fighting took place between the Deer and Mahrihan clans, which used to jointly fight Al-Shabaab years ago. Reuters says the violence erupted on Saturday in the Abdu Wak and Hirali towns of Galamudag region over grazing land and watering points. Personnel from hospitals in the Hirali, Abdu Wak, and two adjacent towns confirmed they had attended to 115 people who were wounded in the fighting. Those who died were buried immediately, residents said. The fighting subsided following the arrival of federal government soldiers. The number of adults in the United States identifying as something other than heterosexual is holding steady at about 7.2%, and the two presidential candidates are taking note. VOA senior Washington correspondent Caroline Prasuti tells us how they are trying to attract that population.
Gallup estimates that a little more than 7% of American adults are lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, or questioning their sexuality, known as LGBTQ. That group protested a 2017 Twitter announcement by then-President Donald Trump that barred transgender people from serving in the military. Less than a week into his presidency, Joe Biden overturned the ban.
Transgender personnel, if qualified in every other way, can serve their government in the United States military.
Sarah Kate Ellis is president and CEO of GLAAD, an LGBTQ organization.
It is quite a relief to have an administration that understands who we are and values us as American citizens.
Also during his term, President Joe Biden signed the Respect for Marriage Act, which gave federal rights and benefits to same-sex couples. Here's what he said to the LGBTQ community during a White House event.
You are loved. You are heard. You are understood. And you belong.
Randy Bravo says he will vote for Biden.
As a gay man, you know, a lot of my rights with the other parties can be in jeopardy. So part of the reason why I do support Biden, not this term, and I did support him last term as well, was because of what he stands for.
Former President Donald Trump was the first president to appoint an openly gay cabinet official, but he has taken an overall more conservative stance. He has said God created two genders, male and female.
What is with pronouns? If you really study it and look at it, it's sick. It's sick. I will protect the content that is pro-God. We're going to protect pro-God context and content.
It's a narrative that his voters stand behind. Like Thomas Isbell, who attended a Trump rally in Ohio.
The Republican sidelines more so with what the Bible says. In terms of eliminating abortion, in terms of getting rid of the LGBTQ.
President Biden has condemned conservative state laws restricting gender-affirming surgery and classes on sexual orientation. Former President Trump promised this on his campaign website.
On day one, I will revoke Joe Biden's cruel policies on so-called gender-affirming care. Ridiculous. A process that includes giving kids puberty blockers, mutating their physical appearance, and ultimately performing surgery on minor children.
Democratic advisor Brad Woodhouse says this is the traditional Republican Party that Republican voters want.
They're anti-immigrant, they're anti-transgender, they're anti-gay, and Trump knew that. He took that. He held on to it.
These voters helped Biden win swing states in 2020. A poll by the advocacy group GLAAD shows the same strong support for Biden, but they overwhelmingly urge the Republican Party to focus on the economy rather than restricting their rights. Caroline Prasuti, VOA News.
And now, time for our Monday Sports Roundup, and I have in our VOA Sports studio Mokbil Yabaro, sports analyst for VOA. Thanks for being with us today, Mokbil.
Thanks for having me, Yeheyes.
So the T20 Cricket World Cup has been a tournament to remember already. Team USA is 2-0. Was that expected?
Oh my goodness, Yeheyes. To be honest with you, the game of cricket is moving at a rapid pace. The excitement behind it happening in this country of America is huge. This is the first time that we are seeing a U.S. team of this caliber play up against, you know, Group A has these teams in it. It's India, USA, Canada, Pakistan, and Ireland. If you were to tell me before the tournament started that the U.S. would have won both games, their two first games, and have beat Canada, maybe, you know, but then beat Pakistan, the world number six ranked team, is really unbelievable. So what a great start for the U.S. At the moment, the only two teams in Group A that are undefeated are India and USA. India is world number one. So they will both be clashing on Wednesday. So we will now get a understanding of where the U.S. truly stands up against the world's best country in cricket. So exciting, exciting stuff. Pakistan, you know, one of the world's best as well, hoping to get their first win against Canada tomorrow. So hopefully they can get some things rolling to get that back in. But unfortunately, they played the U.S. and India and lost in their first two games.
I was just wondering, were there maybe Pakistani-Americans in the U.S.
Absolutely. On the U.S. team, if we look at it, you know, they have Pakistani-Americans, some Indian-Americans, Bangladeshi-Americans. The beauty of multiculturalism,
exactly,
you know, shows on this team. Absolutely. They definitely have, you know, roots in some of the top cricket countries in the world.
So moving forward, Mokbil, the Boston Celtics have taken a commanding 2-0 lead in the NBA Finals against the Dallas Mavericks. Is it over for Dallas?
Oh my goodness, Yeheyes. It's very tough. Coming back from 2-0, what we've seen is, you know, Dallas has an uphill battle that they have to try to make up, you know. Boston, at the moment, with the commanding 2-0 lead that we mentioned, was able to just basically take care of home court, you know. When you have the number one ranked team in the NBA, you have four opportunities to take care of home in a seven-game series. And if you just win at home, you can win it all. So they haven't done anything spectacular, Boston. But now it's the responsibility of the Dallas Mavericks to come out game three and defend home court in game three and game four to make it draw again, but one game at a time. At the moment, if we just look at some stats, we're seeing Luka Doncic still going for about 30 points. He is not really getting any assistance from any of his teammates. Unfortunately, Kyrie Irving, you know, one of the top guards of all time, historically doing exceptional in the playoffs, especially in the championship, in the finals. But he has not had a first two good games, game one and game two, averaging maybe about 15-ish. So we're looking to see him pick up. But also, Yeheyes, lastly, I would say that the role players usually play better at home. So we can expect somebody like a Derrick Jones or a PJ Washington or a Gafford to allow and help alleviate some of the troubles that Luka's having on the scoring side in Dallas, game three.
So in the few minutes remaining, the UEFA, the Union of European Football Associations, Euro 2024, will kick off this Friday, June 14th in Germany. What teams could potentially win it all?
Absolutely. You know, I do know that our producer would love for me to say the England national team definitely has a high possibility of winning it all, which they do if we just look at their, you know, the star power on this team. So it is their tournament to lose. But if they do anything that what we saw that they were doing in that friendly leading up in Iceland, it might get a little shaky. So I would say England would be one in the conversation. France would be in conversation. And if I'm going to throw in another one, maybe Germany in their home court. We'll see.
We'll see. VOA sports analyst Mokbil Yabaro, thank you for your input.
Thank you for having me.
And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. On behalf of our producer, David Van Dee, and our engineer, Helen Cordion, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.